Welcome to episode 3 of Living with Blindness, a program recorded in the studios of the Youngstown Radio Reading Service, a department of Youngstown Area Goodwill Industries. I'm Mike Muter, and I'm going to turn the microphone over now to our own Mike Bosella to introduce our special guest. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Mike. Thank you. Fine as frog's hair, as an old friend of mine used to always say. So how about yourself?
Very good. Just as fine.
Just as fine? We got a couple of frogs then, huh?
Yeah, you
that
got
reminds
it.
Me of a joke about some frog. Oh, I'll tell that at another time.
Some other show, huh?
Yeah, some other show when I do like a comedy stand-up show. But we're, as you said, we're doing our part 3, episode number 3 of Living with Blindness.
Yes.
And we're talking to our good friend, Mr. Larry Carabin. Larry, hi. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mr. Bosella.
Good morning to you, too, sir. By the way, Larry, short for Lawrence, isn't it?
No, it is not.
Oh, it isn't? It's just Larry on your birth certificate?
Yeah, it's just
I love it.
I am so thankful my parents didn't name me Lawrence.
That's great. And now, what's your middle name?
Oh, it's William.
William? Yes. Larry William
Carabin. Yeah, my grandfather's middle name was William, so they gave that to me.
That's nice. But especially nice, that's your name that's on your birth certificate.
Yes.
I wish they would have put Mike on mine, but they put Michael. But I'm with you there. But anyway, you know, we kicked off the show a couple episodes, Larry. And of course, you were there when all of us were there, all five of us, Mike Muter, myself, you, Otha, and Alex, and talked about what we hope to accomplish in this program. And I want to say this. Larry's creative, and he had a title. We're going with the title Living with Blindness, but we want to throw this out here. And Larry had a good one. And Larry, would you share with us what your title was going to be for the program?
Well, I liked it because you said you wanted something that referred to blindness and it wasn't humdrum. I wanted to go with sight unseen.
Yeah, and I think I said snappy, and that qualifies for snappy. So if it ever gets to the point where there's a name change and, you know, we get vast responses from people throughout the world, hey, I will, if they go with that, if they vote for that, I'll go with it, okay?
Well, now, I did win the election among the folks in the hallway that day.
You did, but, you know, I had to disqualify some of the entrants in that election, Larry. You know that.
They were all fine, intelligent people.
They were, but they weren't, you know, people that were involved in the show, the us five. Those were the only ones that had the legitimate right to vote.
Yeah, but they were on my side.
I know. We always cite the people that are on our side, don't we? And I don't blame you for that. Good try, but we'll see what happens as we go along with the program. Because, you know, talking with the, you know, others on the program before you, you know, this is going to go out, you know, on the internet throughout the whole world. You know how, like, the internet's in everywhere. It's in villages in China that we've never heard of. But our task today is to get to know you a little bit better. And I know you're going to be repeating a couple of things. We got the thumbnail sketch before with you about how, you know, your living with blindness began. And so why don't you just start from the beginning and get a little bit more elaborate, and I'll share some of my stories and some things we have in common, how we dealt with, you know, blindness growing up.
Well, I was born with congenital glaucoma, and nobody discovered it until I was a little over 2 years old, and by that time a lot of damage had been done, so I ended up with just a small amount of vision in one eye. And I went through regular public school. It was hard, but I didn't want to be considered one of the blind kids. I didn't want to, you know, yep. I'm normal. I want to go to normal school.
Yep.
You had that thing. You didn't want to, you know, it was hard enough not seeing well. You didn't want the tag of being handicapped on top of it.
Yep.
So I went to regular school. I graduated from Wilson High School in Youngstown. And I worked in private industry after I graduated. For almost 14 years, I had a job with a company in Columbiana. And the eye that I had the vision in, I had a cataract there, and it was starting to make my vision cloudy. It was getting a little harder to do things, and they got nervous about it. This was before the ADA laws had been written.
Mm-hmm.
And the first day back to work after New Year's in 1988, they informed me that I couldn't work for them anymore. So that's how I ended up at the Society for the Blind, because I needed a job. I had two young children.
Yes.
2 and 5 years old, and bills to pay. So I went to the Blind Society to work there. And then when they shut down in 92, all of us that worked there then came over here to Goodwill.
Yeah, that was 1992, March. I think it was maybe March 1st on a Friday. And we commented on earlier programs that, you know, Dick Diamond, Al Slabe, even Mike McBride and Ed Whitaker, they got a lot of the stations, like the Nut Running station, the Flag Line. They got them over here over that weekend. It was pretty amazing. So you came to work that Monday when the society closed down on that Friday, didn't you?
Yeah, we finished up on Friday afternoon on Glenwood Avenue at the old Society for the Blind. And Monday morning, we started here at Goodwill. They worked themselves silly all weekend long.
Yeah, they sure did. Boy, it was impressive. And you began our tenure here at Goodwill. Now, you talked about, you know, like when you were going to school, you wanted to be in the regular class. I say it's something, too. You know, you obviously, I would say, or I should say apparently, were doing well enough that, you know, none of the teachers said, well, he's not keeping up with the other students because of his, you know, visual impairment. So you did well. You were able to cope, and you got things done. Like you said, it wasn't easy, but you did it.
Oh, yeah. They didn't cut any slack. I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
Homework had to be done. It always took me a lot longer, and I hated every minute of it. You know, homework and stuff, reading was just a chore.
Yeah, it wasn't enjoyable for you. You had to go real close.
Yes, and I had to practically have my nose on the page.
Yep.
And literally, I could only focus on like one word at a time. So you're moving your head back and forth across the page. It was just plain hard work.
Yeah, really painstaking would be the word. I mean, I experienced a little bit of that after I was, you know, partially sighted. But anyway, we're talking about you. So that tells me, in a way, you know, when you look back on that, you know, you had to do what you had to do. I'm sure your parents were, you know, forceful with you, like, you're doing this, you got to do this work, okay? We know it's hard for you, but you got to do it. But that tells me you were able to acclimate, you know, to your disability. You only had one eye, and you couldn't see. You probably had the vision, what, 20 over 200?
Probably thereabouts, maybe a little less.
Maybe a little less, but, you know, getting that close to the paper. So you were adapting already. You know, you just did it. There was no plan to tell you how to do it. You just did what you had to do. A lot of people that, you know, have disabilities, and we're talking about our case is the visual, you do what you have to do to stay, quote unquote, no normal. I mean, that was a big thing to me too. After I lost my eyesight, you know, scuffles or playing football, and you know, just things like that, detached retinas. They were able to reattach one of the retinas, but only partially. So I had like 20/200, and I was able to navigate and walk to school and things like that. I went to Woodrow Wilson, but it was very, very hard. I first went to Princeton. And before I could develop the ability to read, as you did, because I was a teenager, I was 14, people would read to me at Princeton. It was really nice. I'd always ask for the girls to read to me, of course, you know, being a normal-blooded teenage boy. But yeah, that never worked out to my, the conclusion I wanted to, you know, become like boyfriend, girlfriend. But they were nice. They were nice kids over at Princeton. This is the mid-60s before things went crazy, and kids were pretty good back then. But anyway, you know, I was able to start reading, and I know exactly what you're saying about holding the thing up to your – how boring is that? And you're reading like a couple words at a time. It's the way I read Braille now. That's why I can't read a book in Braille. I can do my, you know, little notes that I make, or you know, titles to things and stuff like that. But I can't read. But I'm amazed that I was able to read books back then with magnifiers, you know, just to keep, you know, you willing to do that, because you lose interest so quick. So in my mind, what I'm trying to say, in a long roundabout way, you were adapting and learning already, even before, you know, you lost the sight that you had. Talk about that, Larry, where you developed, you know, with the cataract and what happened there.
Oh, you mean when I lost all of the sight?
Yes, and you know, you went to the Cleveland Clinic.
Yeah, as I said, I had the cataract in the eye that I had vision in, and it finally got to a point where the doctor said, yeah, we can take it off. It's not going to give you any more vision, but it will clear up what you have. So,
yeah, and I said, truly believe that.
Yes. Well, it actually, after the surgery, it actually did.
Yes.
I had the surgery up at Cleveland Clinic, and the next morning, my vision was clearer. And they sent me home on a Friday, and everything was fine. I went to bed Friday night. And I woke up Saturday morning with an awful headache and reached for the television next to the bed to turn it on. And I said, why is this TV not working? Why is there no picture? And realized that there wasn't any picture anywhere. I had come to find out that I had gotten strep pneumonia in my eye, common strep germ. They said it's just on your skin. You could have brushed your hand across your eye or whatever. And since it had been open from the surgery, it migrated in and literally just tore the inside of my eye apart. So I lost all of my vision overnight like that. I did have a surgery later on to try and repair the damage. It was almost a 10-hour surgery, and it didn't take.
No.
So this was in January of 93, so I've been blind since then.
Okay. But even before that, like you said, in the late 80s, going back to when you know your vision was weakening, so to speak, a little, your place of work, what was the name of it, if you care to tell us?
It was PhD Manufacturing was the name of the company.
Okay. And they were a little skittish, like they thought you were losing more sight, that they were, you know, it's going to be dangerous for yourself and dangerous to them as far as liability. They asked you to let you go?
Yeah. They never came to me. Had they come to me and said, look, you know, we noticed you're doing things a little differently and we'd rather have you, do something this way or that way, I would have been more than happy to work with them. But I guess they were worried about, you know, is he going to walk out in front of a tow motor, which, you know, good Lord, who would do that? But, you know, people think like that.
Right.
So
right.
Rather than, you know, come to me and let's see what we can work out, maybe it would have been, you know, in the end, okay, this isn't going to work. But rather than discuss it with me, they just made their decision and, you know, came to me, and they didn't even, they let me work a whole day.
Yeah.
It was quitting time. It was 15 minutes before time to punch out, and they called me into the office and said, you know, by the way, you don't work here anymore.
Oh, I'll tell you, they got a day of work out of you. You know, I just don't like you said earlier, it was 2 years before the ADA in 1990. I mean, you could have done something after that, because obviously you'd worked there for what, 11, 13 years, did you say, before
that? Yeah, I started there in 1974.
Yeah, but see, you know, they don't have any concept of what you accomplished, okay? Having the 20 over 200, you were doing your job. There was no qualms, right? You were a great employee, I would say, obviously.
Well, yeah, I mean, I did the work that was required of me.
Right.
I did the same jobs as everybody else did. I ran a machine, and, you know, I did what everybody else did.
Yeah. You know, quote unquote, sighted people.
Yeah, and the people, my coworkers, they were fine.
They knew.
None of them had a problem with it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, 2 years before the ADA, they couldn't get away with that now. But I am a little disappointed. I'm not calling them out, okay? But I'm a little disappointed. Why not say, well, Larry, let's see, can we do something in the office? You know, you're a bright guy, you know, nice personality. You could deal with customers or something. It's just like back then, you know, even after ADA, people have tried to skirt around it to individuals, you know, try to, you know, not give them their due rights, okay? So this was before it, so it was a different atmosphere. So I'm not, you know, indicting them. I'm just saying what could have happened. So the reason I make that big point is what we're talking about here. People are all aware of the ADA now. It's going on 30 years, okay? But, you know, if they're hearing our program, they can reach out to us and we can tell them things. There are lawyers that specialize in ADA. And maybe hearing this program, if there's a similar situation, someone with partial sight that maybe be losing it, they can reach out to us, or you know there's other avenues, many avenues, like equal rights and, you know, things like that, where they know about the ADA laws and a person wouldn't lose their opportunity, you know, just because they're losing their sight. They could do different jobs now, especially with technology. You know, that's opened the doors for a lot of people for a lot of different jobs that are visually impaired.
Yeah, but you do have to start a dialogue, and just from my own experience over the years, you have to learn to keep your cool. You can't go in and be, I call it militancy.
Yes.
You can't go in and demand, you have to do this for me because I'm handicapped and the law says so. That puts a lot of people off and closes a lot of doors to you. You have to go in and be reasonable and say, look, you know, we can work things out here. I may not do something the way that you would do it, but I can get the job done. I can figure out my own way, and as long as it works and gets done what needs to be done, who cares? But if you go in with that chip on the shoulder attitude, you've just closed the door completely to yourself.
I agree with you. The thing about a dialogue is absolutely correct. There's been organizations, you know, for the blind, okay, and they've achieved a lot, but a lot of it was militancy, okay, in the beginning. Like, for instance, you and I have talked about this, and we both agree. The thing about airplanes, what, 30, 40 years ago, about sitting by the emergency exit, you know, people that who were blind or are visually impaired, they were asked to move from that emergency exit door or seat that's by the door, and they started a big, big demonstration over that. And I thought it was fruitless. I really did. Well, you know, share your feelings with me about that.
Well, yeah, it got them on the news. There was an incident out here at the Youngstown Airport.
Yes.
And, you know, it got the woman on the news, but it accomplished nothing. If it did anything, it hardened a lot of people's attitudes against handicapped people, because you know, here's somebody who obviously in an emergency, I don't want to be sitting by an emergency exit with everybody else trying to get out behind me. I don't know what's on the other side of that door when you open it up.
Yeah.
I want somebody who can see to go through it first.
Yeah.
But for me to raise all kind of cane, all that did was make a lot of people angry and say, you know what, I don't want anything to do with these people. I don't even want them on the plane.
Yep. In times they do, they use that in a lot of other movements, you know, different than, you know, disability awareness, okay? Equal rights or whatever. When you're militant, it's just going to make people get up their dander and, you know, they're going to get their back up and fight you on it. You know, they're not mean people. They're just not aware of what you can do when you're disabled. I mean, why should they be if they've lived a quote-unquote normal life?
Well, yeah, most people haven't had any kind of contact with handicapped people. And you don't want to be militant, but you do have to... You do have to have a backbone. You have to stand your ground. But there's ways to do that that you don't have to be angry and start shouting and stomping and pounding the table.
I agree with you completely. And if you know your own abilities, you know, be assertive, you know, have a backbone, as you say. But say, let's talk. Just try to do that. That's the big thing. Let's talk, a dialogue, as you said. That's what you want to do, and give yourself a chance to prove it to them that you can do it. But, you know, people, it got attention. Maybe it moved things along. I don't know where that stands now. If you're allowed to sit by an emergency, I still wouldn't want to sit there. Would you?
No, I wouldn't either.
I don't want to. I don't want to. Like you say, you might get trampled to death. You hear stories about that when people are freaking out. When your life's on the line, you think it's going to end. You're not going to be polite and let the blind person go first or, you know, move to the side, Larry, please. So, yeah, but it's a way, and, you know, for all different groups that want awareness of their situation, whatever it is, I can't, you know, count them out here, but especially for disabled, it's people thought that was the way to do it, scream and yell and things like that.
Well, and I guess back then, probably in the beginning, some of that had to be done to get some attention, but... You know, those days have passed.
Yep, they're certainly passed. You know, we have the ADA, started in 1990. George Bush, the senior, you know, signed the law. And a lot of people who were visually impaired and totally blind were there. I guess it was quite an affair. I've read articles about it, you know, where they were there and, you know, people were crying and, you know. But almost 30 years, and there's still some things that need to be caught up with that. But that's always going to be a battle when you're different than the majority of the population. That's just the way it is, and you better get used to it.
Yeah, life isn't static. Everything changes all the time.
Right. And, you know, we talked about technology. It makes it an equal, you know, playing field for us, like, you know, running radio stations. If you have been doing here at the Youngstown Radio Reading Service, we're able to enter programs after the volunteers read them and, you know, keep them in a server. You know, then, you know, they're transferred into a calendar that plays them. So it's amazing what, you know, radio has become. You could do a four-hour shift in like an hour on commercial radio playing songs like that. So technology has really leveled the playing field. Wouldn't you say, since we got the invention of JAWS, a screen reader?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I do have to say that the little bit of time I've been here at Radio Reading, I enjoy the work here. I haven't done a whole lot of it yet, but what I have been doing, I've enjoyed.
It's been enjoyable teaching you and how you've taken to it. You know, it's really, really well. But you've had a lot of background. You use the computer for your own personal banking, a lot of reading your mail with the open book program, they call it. So, you were well-versed. So
yeah, I read all of my mail myself. I don't have to have – that was that's like a godsend that you don't have to have – somebody else knowing all of your personal private business, reading your mail, with the computer, I can do that myself.
Yep. I plead to, could do a little, but I don't have a computer at home. I have one here at work, but I'm saving it for another project. But even, in a relationship, if you're a person, a man who's blind and your wife is sighted, you still want to do it yourself. There's a certain feeling about doing it yourself that you've conquered something. Don't you feel? I mean, it gives you a sense of, I don't know, pride, but you're doing stuff yourself.
You're not dependent on someone else for everything.
Right. And we're dependent on so much, all right, in programs in the future. As we talk, we're going to talk about transportation, talk about jobs. And you'll have a lot over, you and Alex will have a lot over, even Otha, over me. You guys worked in the private sector first. So, you held your own before Alex's accident. Okay, he worked in manufacturing areas and things like that. You did for 13 years, a PhD. Now, a little side note here, didn't the Society for the Blind have a contract with PhD?
Yeah, they did.
While you were working there?
Yes.
Did that ever run through your mind, like, those guys?
Yeah, well, no.
Huh?
The job that I did used the parts that the Blind Society sent to them. Yeah, I handled those things every day. So every time I picked up a bolt, it's like, I know somebody who did that.
Yeah, isn't that kind of like ironic that, you were there doing that and then eventually you came there? I mean, it's just like, it's funny how life takes you in so many different directions.
Yeah, I ended up working both ends of it.
Yeah, who would ever thunk that, if you wouldn't have had that, the infection that you had. But, not that the medical, profession needs me. They've come a long way with infections, with operations. Now they load you up a week ahead of time with antibiotics to protect against stuff that happened to you, where, you had something on your hand and brushed against your eye, and you got that infection, the pneumonia. I mean, it's just amazing how they've made progress and how we're trying to, be available, these podcasts, to provide help to people. Who knows? We don't know. We have to have a belief that we're reaching out to somebody, that we're doing this, and it's going to help them if they try to contact us or, if it gives them some gumption. Like if they're, one of the worst violators of keeping disabled people back, Larry, and this, we'll talk about this, are their parents, okay? They're well-meaning.
Yeah, they want to protect them from.
And you just can't. You can't, and that's got to be a tough thing. I've never been a parent. You've been a parent, so you both your boys are quote-unquote normal. And we'll talk about that with the three of you, raising children while you're blind. But, some of the worst violators, and it's out of love they want to protect you, but they're really hurting you.
Yeah, they want to keep you from – they want to keep their kids from getting hurt, and they think, this may be too hard for them. It's just quicker if I do it. And, I mean, that may be fine up to a point, but the parents aren't going to be around forever.
Nope.
And that kid is going to have to eventually be on his own.
Yep. Exactly. And you know how other kids are. They would tease you, you can't tie your shoe. Why don't you call your mommy? Stuff like that. But it's kind of like Pink Floyd. You a fan of Pink Floyd?
Yes.
Mama's going to build a wall all around you. I don't think they were talking about disabled. It's just about the tendency of parents to do everything for their kids.
To keep your kid from getting hurt.
Right. To keep them from getting hurt. And especially they're more protective when it comes to disabled. So, Larry, I'm glad I got a chance to mention Pink Floyd in this conversation today. One of my favorite groups. How do you feel about them?
I like them. I think my favorite album is The Dark Side of the Moon.
I'm with you 100%. That's what exploded for Pink Floyd, don't you think?
Yeah.
That where it got the mainstream, everybody involved. There was a couple before that I really liked, but, Dark Side really opened up a lot of ears, so to speak, of new fans, and it was played so much, it got ingrained in me. So, but yeah, they addressed that issue, great, what do I want to say, groundbreaking band as far as, concept albums and stuff
like that. Seems like a whole lifetime ago.
Oh, doesn't it? Well, it's 46 years ago,
yeah,
73.
Back in the 70s, yeah. 72,
holy
73.
Cow. Holy cow. Who'd have thunk that I would have turned it over to Pink Floyd in this conversation?
Well, you know what, Mike? Right. I'm glad you did, because you mentioned the word groundbreaking.
Yes.
And I like to think that's what this program is.
Oh man, what a guy tying that all together, huh, Larry?
Lovely segue.
Yes, lovely segue, and that's what we're hoping. We're all giving this an earnest shot, a sincere shot, you know, hoping that we can help somebody. You know, that's what it's all about, and, you know, try to give back. You know, we've been, you know, lucky to a certain extent, you know, with our conditions and having a place to work. So I'm thankful for it. And as you said, Mike, I like what you said, groundbreaking. We hope that's what it is.
Well, you also mentioned about contacting us, and we'd like to include this in every program, too. I can give you contact information for us. You know, Youngstown Radio Reading Service, Youngstown Area Goodwill Industries. We're at 2747 Belmont Avenue, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. The website is www.goodwillyoungstown.org. You can also find the Youngstown Radio Reading Service stream on the Goodwill website. We're also available through Amazon Alexa as well. And our phone numbers, our direct number for radio reading is 330-759-0100. And the main number for Goodwill Industries is 330-759-7921.
Very good.
I guess that's about it. Our time's about up.
Well, I'm going to say goodbye first and let Larry get the last word. Usually in our discussions, I try not to let him get the last word, but today I'm going to let Larry Carabin have the last word.
Well, I'll have to behave because we're on the air. So we'll have our personal last words later.
But
thanks for the opportunity for the interview, and you and Mike both make it easy. So I appreciate that, gentlemen. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, very good. Thank you both, Mike and Larry. That does conclude this program for both Larry Carabin and Mike Bosella. I'm Mike Muter, and thanks for listening to Episode 3 of Living with Blindness.